Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Layla Yaghi. Not a household name, but I hope she will be, and her son, by the time this program ends. Layla is the mother of a U.S. political prisoner. He committed no crimes. The only crime, quote-unquote, he's guilty of is being Muslim in America at the wrong time. That's a crime. America declared war on Islam post 9/11, and Muslims in America are not safe. They can be targeted for any reason. I personally have written on dozens of individual cases, 50, 60, 70. I long ago lost count. I have yet to find one single person guilty of anything. No plots, no crimes, no intention to commit them. But these people are in prison, and some of them are there for a very, very long time. The largest Muslim charity in America, doing extraordinary work, the Holy Land Foundation, the Bush administration, shut them down and imprisoned five of their principals. It's been a while, but I had a program on it, and I certainly wrote about it more than once. Terrible, terrible abuse. The lead principals, if I recall rightly, each got about 60 years in prison for doing what? In their words, supplying toys, not tanks, and books, not bombs. It's a crime in America now. Well, Ziad Yaghi is one of the victims. Again, he committed no crime, but he was framed, he was prosecuted, he was convicted. Juries are intimidated to convict, literally intimidated, pressured, and if they don't do it the first time, which occasionally happens, new charges are filed. And I wrote about one case where it took three trials to get some innocent people down in South Florida convicted of stuff they never even imagined, including blowing up the Sears Tower in Chicago. I'm sure they've never been to Chicago, maybe never even heard of the Sears Tower, let alone blow it up. I don't know how anybody could blow up the Sears Tower. Maybe if you had a missile, you could do it. Anyway, two trials. These young kids, either hung juries or they were exonerated. New charges were filed. The third attempt, they were convicted. When the long knives from Washington want to go after somebody, they just keep doing it until they get them. Guilt or innocence doesn't matter. It's guilty by accusation. And that's the terrible situation that Ziad found himself in. Layla, I welcome you to the program. I'll mention one more thing. I don't get a chance to meet people who come on this program very often, but you and I met in Chicago, and that makes your visit here on the program a little extra special for me. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Steve. Thank you.
You have been an impassioned supporter for your son, and it's more than a mission to free your son. You have a website that I posted as Free Ziad Yaghi, and now I guess it's called, give the correct name for listeners able to find it.
It is freeziadyaghi.info.
.info.
And so, his name is spelled Ziyad, and then Yaghi.
And again, Ziyad, as in David, Yag, as in George, H-I. And listeners need to know about your son, Layla. Because, again, it's one of the many horror stories that is shocking and abusive and intolerable in a country daring to call itself a democracy. Well, I don't call this country a democracy. I call it a vicious, tyrannical regime. Doesn't matter who's running the thing. When they put innocent people in prison, my God, whether it's for 30 days or 30 minutes or 30 years, I mean, this is intolerable. I won't tolerate it, but you're a mother, and your fear is that you won't see your son for the next 30 years. Outrageous. But talk about him. You set up the website. You write about him. You follow him. You support him, and I want to help. I wrote about him, too.
Thank you, Steve. Yes, I do write about my son, and I have also a Facebook page for me and him also under Layla Yagi, and please support Ziad Yagi. And we've been going through this for 3 years, and it's been a nightmare for both me and him. And honestly, I don't sleep most of the nights, and I can't even function properly. I'm always spaced out because I'm constantly thinking about my son's condition because he's in constant lockdown. So not only did they charge him falsely, they also convicted him falsely, and they're also mistreating him, and they keep moving him around because every time he gets some kind of support, they don't like to have people writing him letters, so they keep moving him around, and he's been moved around probably, I would say, at least 10 times, if not more, in the last 3 years.
You mean from one prison to another?
Yes, sir, yes. And I just found out yesterday that he was in Greenville, and then they just moved him again today. So we're assuming that they're taking him back to Florida because there was a trial going for one of his co-defendants that severed his trial, and he was representing himself, so he subpoenaed my son from Florida to North Carolina, and he asked my son a couple of questions, and then they had my son in Tarboro, North Carolina, and then after my son was asked a couple of questions, they moved him to Newburn, North Carolina, and then they just moved him yesterday to Greenville, and then today I found out that they moved him again.
Layla, it's deliberately done to make it hard for you or other family members of other victims in America's gulag, which let's call it what it is. It's a gulag. It literally is a gulag. It's shocking. It's disgraceful. I've written a lot about the U.S. prison system in general, let alone what it does to Muslims in America. A lot of other people are in U.S. prisons as well, unjustifiably. Some committed offenses that are no worse than misdemeanors, that they should have gotten a reprimand and absolutely no prison time, but they're just horrible, and they move prisons around to make it hard for family members to get to see them.
Yeah, and even for supporters, like, because now some people are supporting me on Facebook, they write him letters, so they don't like that, so they keep moving him around, so they would lose contact with my son. But I keep reposting the new address. As soon as I find out, I repost it on Facebook. But do you want me to tell you about the story about what happened to my son? Do you want me to go ahead and say?
Oh, go ahead. Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Well, my son's first interest became in Jordan when his father, my son really didn't have any contact with his father because his father was physically abusive towards him and me and towards my older son. So we were living in upstate New York, Albany, New York, and we came down to North Carolina. I had to run, basically take my son and run away to Raleigh, North Carolina, because he was very abusive towards me and his kids. So we came down to North Carolina. And then when my son turned 15, he said he wanted to know his father. I didn't really tell him much about his father. So I said, no, I don't think you're ready to see your dad at this point. And he said, no, I want to really see my dad. So I allowed him. He was about 15 years old. He went to visit his dad, and his dad threw him out after 4 months. So, but I think during that time, I think he took him to Jordan, and that's when he fell in love with Jordan because we have a lot of relatives from there. That's where I come from. I'm an American. I'm mixed. My mom is white American, and my father's Palestinian-Jordanian. But I lived a lot of my life also in Jordan. Most of my life was here in Raleigh, but I also lived in Jordan. So my son liked Jordan because he had grandparents there, aunts, uncles, and a lot of and cousins, and you name it. And they were all very friendly to him. So then he came back. When he came back, he wanted to go back there when he turned 18. So he went there when he was 18 to get married because in our religion, in Islam, we marry very young. I married when I was 18. My mom also married when she was 18. She was Christian at the time, but she got married to my dad, who was a Muslim, when she was 18. My sister got married when she was 18. So it goes on like that in our tradition. We get married when we're, like, very, very young. So he went up there to look for a bride and to learn Arabic because we speak English at home. So he really wanted to learn Arabic. Well, so it was normal. He didn't do anything illegal or he didn't do anything wrong. He met with one young lady, and his uncle just showed him one young lady. It didn't work out between them. So he came back. And then a year later, he went with his friend, who's originally from Egypt. They went to Jordan, They went to Palestine and they were denied entry, and then they went to Jordan and they stayed probably a week over there, and then they went to Egypt and they probably stayed a month over there. And we have pictures on Facebook showing them going to the beach and showing them having fun and meeting up with friends and relatives of Omar Yagi, who's also now in jail, which is my son's best friend. And then after them coming back, they were questioned and harassed and questioned and harassed and questioned and harassed. And then, you know, finally my son said, I don't even have to talk to you guys. He told them the truth. He said he was going there to get married and, you know, to visit family members and learn Arabic. Then after 2 years of them coming back from overseas, after 2 full years, okay, the first time my son was 18, the second time he was 19, when my son turned 21, okay, they arrested my son, and they put up a big show. You know, they had a SWAT team arrest my son. They had the roads closed. My son was swimming at the pool. He had just marinated the chicken because he wanted to surprise me and cook a nice dinner for me. He had cleaned up the kitchen. I had gone out of the house to run an errand for an older lady who couldn't drive. And then when I came back, I saw his cell phone on the computer table, and I got really worried. I said, this is not normal. So I got really, really worried, and I started looking around for my son, and then I got a call from an older lady. The same older lady who I went to run her errands called me and said, have you seen the news? I said, no. She said, your son is in jail. So I said, what? How can that be? And she said, yes, he is. And I started crying and screaming and jumping up and down. And it's like, why would my son be in jail? The next day he calls me and he tells me he doesn't know why he's in jail. And at the same time, the FBI came to question me. And they told me that the reason your son is in jail because there's some piece of the puzzle missing that Boyd, the one they call the ringleader, that my son knows something about Boyd. And we told him, I told the FBI, you've been asking us the same question over for over 2 years, and we don't know anything, and do you want us to lie? Would that satisfy you if we lie? So I escorted him out to the door, and I told him, please not to come back. And, of course, I continued to cry. And till this day, you know, I cry so often, I cannot function. And also, you know, after that, he was in solitary, and he was in lockdown most of the time, most of his 3 years. And they were trying to pressure him to plead guilty and to testify against the one they call the ringleader. And my son said he's...
Lena, explain what lockdown means. Do you mean isolation?
Yes. They put him in a very small cell. Imagine your small, you know, the half bathroom that you have. And he would be there all day long, and he's allowed an hour a day out of his cell to shower and use the phone. And, of course, if he's in the SHU, he's not allowed to use the phone except once a month, which is worse than solitary confinement, which is, you know, worse than lockdown. But, he's just allowed an hour a day out of his cell.
So he's kept in solitary confinement. Is he all alone by himself, or is someone there with him?
No, for most of the time he was alone.
Alone, and
yes.
1 hour a day he's allowed out of his cell.
Yes.
I've written about how that works. It is absolutely outrageous. And I remember a couple of times, Layla, writing about the experience of solitary confinement that I can't imagine, nor can anyone imagine if they haven't gone through it themselves. But I remember saying it this way to try to explain it to people and to myself. And I said, imagine having a small bathroom, a small windowless bathroom, and you had to go there with, say, a mat to lie down on the floor and spend the next 24 hours there with enough food and water to get you through the 24-hour period. But you couldn't come out, and you had no windows, and you were all by yourself, and you had no way to communicate with anybody, and you stayed there for 24 hours. At the end of the 24 hours, you'd be going nuts.
Exactly.
And then my tagline, Layla, was, now imagine spending years of the rest of your life there.
Right.
I mean, if people spend enough time in isolation, it's enough to drive some of them insane. You know,
yeah,
depending on how long they're there.
They're trying to drive him crazy, and we don't even know why. We don't even know why they're doing this to us. And at the end, I just said it has to do just, you know, because of our religious beliefs. Nothing else. Nothing else makes sense to me. Nothing else.
And this is done just to gratuitously punish someone for no other reason than that. There's no reason for doing it. There's no reason to do it. There's no reason to have an innocent person in prison. But the prisons are just full of so many, dare I say, I want to say, for sure thousands, I want to say tens of thousands of innocent people in America's gulag, and I'm talking about the one inside the 48 states, maybe in Alaska as well, Hawaii, besides the overseas gulag, that's another issue altogether. This torture over there, it's also torture in U.S. prisons. I mean, it's just horrific what goes on. And then you put prisoners in isolation. I've written about it a few times. I've written how experts describe the effects of people who they see and describe what happens to them over a protracted period of time. It's really a very disturbing story. And the authorities that put people under these conditions, they literally do it to be malicious, to be vicious. What kind of a country does stuff like this?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't know. It's just been a nightmare for both my son and me, and I, to the point that I can't even function properly. I've just been constantly depressed because of this. And, you know, people don't understand. My friends don't understand. My community doesn't understand. Even my managers don't understand. And how you know, it's been affecting me so much to the point that it's just consuming me. It's just like somebody carrying two heavy weights, you know, constantly with them every second of the day. And this has been always, you know, in the background of my mind that, you know, how can I be even, I can't even if when I smile, you know, the people say that my eyes look really sad. It's just ridiculous what they're doing to my son, and there's no reason, and I can't justify it.
Leila, I know what you're saying. Anybody who's lost loved ones, I think to some degree understands what you're saying. You know, when you get old enough, you lose your parents, you may lose a sibling, a spouse. Anybody who goes through that knows the grieving that follows. And it takes a while, especially someone especially close to you, which would either be a spouse or a son or a daughter. But, you know, losing a father or a mother isn't easy either. And there's a lot of pain associated with that. A regular on this program, Leila, I was shocked that he took ill and he passed away. Bob Chapman. Bob Chapman was a regular on this program on the economy, on finance, on economics, politically related issues. And I recall the last time he was on this program, which was in April. It wasn't the same Bob Chapman. He didn't sound himself, and I had no idea what was wrong. I thought he just had an off day, and then I found out weeks later that he was extremely ill. The main problem was pancreatic cancer that was killing him. He was dying, and he didn't say anything to anybody. His wife knew. His wife knew, but he didn't even tell his children. He didn't talk about it. And then he canceled out of coming on my program the next time I had him scheduled. And I said, well, I don't know what's going on. Maybe he hasn't recovered fully yet, whatever was going on, and he'll be back. And then I checked with his wife about the possibility of scheduling him on my program again, and I got a shocking email saying he won't be doing any more interviews. And it was only a few days after that that I learned that he passed away. And it was very disturbing to me. He was 1 year my junior, 1 year. Well, I wrote about him. And he was married. He and his wife married 47 years, I believe. So, and this happened just a few weeks ago. So you can imagine, Leila, the grieving that she is going through and will for some time.
God help her. May God help her, my God.
Oh, very, very, very tough. He tried lots of cures. Nothing worked, and he had everything to live for, and he was a very valued guest because he was a long-time Wall Street insider. He had his own business. He worked around the world. He knew what was going on, and he discussed it very honestly and openly. And he was a source of information that I don't find other places. So for me and for listeners to this program, he was a great loss. Aside from the loss, the personal loss of losing somebody, he was also a friend. In that respect, it was a great loss, and the information that he was able to convey, a great loss, but very tough. I'm citing it now mainly to talk about his wife, who is still going through a very, very hard transition period, and it'll go on for a good while.
Poor lady, poor lady.
And, of course, with you, Layla, it's the issue of your son. And it's one thing to—I mean, if you lost your son for any reason, my goodness, I have a dear Chicago friend who 2 or 3 years ago lost her husband in a tragic car accident. A tragic car accident. You know, anything that happens, like you get up in the morning and it's just a normal every day, and it was the winter time, and apparently he skid on ice or something, and crashed into some object that was harsh enough to kill him. And, and who can imagine that he would leave in the morning and never come home, and that was it. And so anything could happen anytime. And I'm sure she's still grieving. I'm sure she's still grieving even a couple of 3 years later. And they both were fairly young, certainly much too young to pass away. And anything can happen anytime. I'm old enough to maybe I'll wake up one morning and not feel well and discover I have some terrible health problem that I have to deal with, and whether I will be able to or not, who knows. But whether you're young or old or in between, it doesn't matter. Anything can happen to anybody anytime. And so many ways, whether it's health or the issue that you're going through, Layla. But, I mean, health is one thing. Health sooner or later affects everybody. I mean, we all pass away at some point. Some go easy, some go hard. Bob Chapman went hard. Pancreatic cancer is not easy, and it's very, very tough to treat, and it's very hard to come back from, unless you catch it very early, which he didn't. And your situation were just a terrible tragedy. I mean, it never should have happened. It's not a question of getting ill, and, you know, what are you going to do? People get sick, so you when you get sick, you treat it. But in your case, you have your son locked up in prison, not having committed any crime. The crime was committed by the authorities who run this country, targeting innocent people and putting them in prison. There's a name for countries that do that kind of stuff, and it's called despotism, a tyranny. And that's the way I describe America now.
That's for sure. Even the trial, the way it was done so unjustly. They had, you know, the jury about most of them were older, much, much older people, and they were from New Bern. It was held like 2 hours and at least 15 minutes away from where we are in Raleigh, and so it was none of his peers, of course, and probably a lot of people, you know, who never heard about Islam, and the way they portrayed Islam at the court was, you know, that the Muslim people tend to be very violent, and then they brought hours and hours of tape recording that was not, we could not hear what, you know, the ringleader supposedly saying, but it was filled in, you know, it was filled in by the prosecutors, like any blank, any word we could not understand was filled in by the prosecutors and handed to the jury. So the prosecutors basically filled in whatever they wanted to fill in and handed the transcripts to the jury. So when the jury couldn't understand what's going on in the tape, they would read, you know, the transcripts. So everything was done, you know, to prove that, you know, Muslims are violent and they're not good people and whatever. And even though the 700 and hours of tape they had on the one they call the ringleader that put some of the jury to sleep because it was so boring, my son was not in any of that tape recordings. So we thought that my son is going to get acquitted. But the prosecutors were intimidated the jury, and they brought in material that was so biased. They brought in videotapes. They brought in video. I mean, of somebody, like, I guess, beheading somebody else, and what had nothing to do with my son. They also got a man named Evan Coleman that they say that he's an expert on Muslim people, that say that the Muslim people are extremists, you know, tend to think in a certain way, and eventually they're going to commit a crime, and they also scare the jury. They also brought in, you know, a lot of ammunition that Boyd, the one they call the ringleader, had at his home that was all legal. They brought it into court, and they held each one and showed it to the jury, which also had nothing to do with my son. So everything that was done in court was done, in my eyes, in my opinion, illegally, because none of that had anything to do with my son. America, and it was allowed in court.
Oh, indeed. America needs enemies, Layla. Back in the Cold War, the enemy was communism. So, you know, the evil empire, the old Soviet Union, and communist China. They still call China communist China. My God, China is as capitalist as America and Western European countries, but they still refer to it as communist China. Outrageous. But when the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, they needed new enemies. Well, Islam became the enemy slowly. First, it was Saddam Hussein with the Gulf War in 1991. January 1991, it began, and post 9/11. I mean, this was planned long before the 9/11 event. There was a state-sponsored false flag. There's no question about that. But you need enemies, so the enemy became Islam, and you accuse Muslims because in the eyes of Judeo-Christian America, they pray to the wrong God. Well, the same God. I mean, anybody who knows anything about the history of religions, and I once took a course in it back in college, the roots of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism are the same. They're the same. And the basic tenets of the Quran or the New and Old Testament, they're pretty close to each other. The basic ideas, they don't differ very much. I mean, there may be some rituals that differ, but the rituals don't matter. Just like in Judaism, Layla, you know, Orthodox Jews pray with a talus, and some with tefillin they wrap around their arms every day, and conservative Jews don't bother with that, and I don't bother with any of that. but it doesn't mean I'm evil and I should be targeted as an enemy. I mean, whatever rituals you practice or don't practice have nothing to do with your ethics or your morals or anything else. Certainly has nothing to do with whether or not you've committed a crime. But Islam is the enemy. Muslims are the enemy. And again, America needs this, Layla, to justify waging a phony war on terror, waging war against one country after another. I call it ravaging the world one country at a time, with more wars always planned. Syria is the next one. Make no mistake about it. It's getting closer to it all the time. And poor Muslims pay the cost. And you'll see inflammatory headlines in major U.S. papers on U.S. television about another terror plot stopped by the FBI. Terror plot. There are no terror plots. You know, there are fake shoe bombers and fake underwear bombers and fake Times Square bombers and fake shampoo bombers and fake Fort Dix bombers and North Carolina bombers. They're all fake. There's nothing real about them. We're almost at the end of the program, Layla. I want to let you wrap up with your final thoughts.
Okay. I just wanted to say, even though, like, they create these terrorists, well, my son, when he's indicted, there's really nothing that he's accused of, except that there was a plan for him to do something at some specific time that's unknown. And when my son was given the chance to plea guilty, take the plea deal, and it would be like 10 years, and then he'd be out, you know, time served, and 80% of the time, so he ended up like 6 years, versus, you know, he knew he was gambling with probably a life term. He said that he's not going to lie and testify falsely against others. But when his co-defendant who pleaded guilty and took the plea deal so he can save his children who are also with him in jail, and they'll be out in 4 years, and he'll be out probably, who knows, you know, and he saved his health. When he was cross-examined, he said there was no plan between him and my son to do any kind of act of terrorism. There was no conspiracy and all that. And yet he still got convicted.
Shocking shame, Layla. We are out of time. Again, Layla Yaghi, we talked about Layla's son, Ziad, an innocent man, 30.5 years in prison for being Muslim in America at the wrong time. Layla, I thank you very much. We indeed will stay in touch with each other.
Thank you, Steve, so much for having me.
Thank you, Layla. And join us every Thursday, same time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.